This is a CBC podcast. Your community, your environment, your business. They all connect to make up the world we live in. Now, IBM wants to give you the tools to help build a smarter planet. Join the conversation for change. Learn more by visiting cbc.ca/smartshift.
How do we deal with a world where we need to convey information for an attention span the size of a tweet?
One.
This is your life.
Two.
This is your digital life.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, and this is Spark, Tech Trends and Fresh Ideas. This time around, you know, it's funny, technology is usually thought of as giving us control, but often it brings with it unintended consequences. Like, could transparency be undermining democracy instead of improving it? Could digital communication be ruining your love life? But first up, could spam be helping the internet? Delete. Looky here, an email from someone claiming to be a prince in a faraway land who just has $18 million that he needs my help to get. Delete. Question about your account. Please resubmit your username and password. Delete. Ashamed about the size of your manhood? Ugh. Control-Alt-Delete. Spam! Is there no end to it? Probably not. But one of the most effective barriers to spam is the CAPTCHA. It stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart, with a couple of extra T's thrown in there. You've probably seen CAPTCHAs in your travels on the web. It's that set of blurred or squiggly letters that you have to type out when you want to do things like leave a comment at a blog or sign up for a new email account or buy tickets online. You know how the screen prompts you to type a word like rainbow, but what you see is something close to
rainbow?
Hammer looks like
hammer.
They work because it's easy for human beings to read even blurry letters, but hard for computer programs. So what you're doing is proving you're a human being and not a computer program. And that can have real benefits beyond you just having to delete all those cheap Viagra emails. For instance, it means that scalpers can't automatically buy up millions of tickets from online ticket sellers two at a time just by running a program posing as a human.
At some point, we did this calculation that about 200 million CAPTCHAs are typed every day by people around the world.
That's Luis von Ahn.
And I am a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University.
And Luis, he invented those CAPTCHAs that get typed hundreds of millions of times a day.
Now, when I first heard this number, I was quite proud of myself. I thought, look at the impact that my research has had. Mm-hmm. But then I started feeling bad because the thing is, each time you type a CAPTCHA, essentially you waste 10 seconds of your time. And if you multiply that by 200 million, you get that humanity as a whole is wasting like 500,000 hours every day typing these annoying CAPTCHAs.
Right.
So then I started feeling bad. And then I started thinking, you know, during those 10 seconds while you're typing a CAPTCHA, your brain is doing something amazing. Your brain is doing something that computers cannot yet do. So is there any way in which we can use that time for something that's good for humanity?
Smart, right? This is a fresh idea we've noticed before on Spark, harnessing the byproducts of some activity that humans are already doing for some other purpose, especially when that activity is happening online where thousands or millions of people are doing it. And that insight led Luis to come up with reCAPTCHAs.
So the idea with reCAPTCHA is that as you're typing a CAPTCHA, not only are you authenticating yourself as a human, but in addition, mm-hmm. you're helping us by digitizing books. There's a lot of projects out there trying to digitize books, so basically taking all these books that were written before the computer age and, you know, scanning them. You start with an old book, like a physical book, then you scan it. The computer needs to be able to decipher the scans so that the computer can search through it, so that way you can actually search through the text of the book.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this is that for older books, for things that were written before like 1900, the ink has faded. And the computer cannot recognize a lot of the words. So what we're doing now is we're taking all the words that the computer cannot recognize, and we're getting mm-hmm. people to read them for us while they're typing CAPTCHAs on the internet. So what you may not know now is that whenever you see a CAPTCHA, the words that you type actually come from books that are being digitized, and the stuff that you type is used in order to basically get the computers to recognize what words those are from the book.
You know, it's such an incredible example of what happens when you have this incredible volume of activity on the internet. I mean, from the point of view of one person, it's trivial. But when you add up all those people typing all those captchas, it's quite remarkable.
That's right. You get to a very large number of things transcribed every day.
You're involved in this project, GWAP, Games with a Purpose, where people play games that improve search engines. Can you explain, first of all, how GWAP works?
The basic idea is it's a bunch of games in there. These are pretty fun games. Some people really, really like these games. And as people are playing these games, as a side effect, they're actually solving problems that computer cannot yet solve. So this is somewhat similar to what was happening with ReCAPTCHA, where we're giving a tiny bit of a problem that a computer cannot solve to some person playing a game. So I think probably the most successful example out of these is one of the games is called the ESP game, mm-hmm. where the basic idea is as people are playing, they're actually labeling images for us. So they're telling us what's in just random images. So it could be an image of a dog. They're telling us that there's a dog in there. And the reason this is useful is to improve image search on the web.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing what's inside images helps us improve image search on the web.
So basically, by playing the game, humans are creating tags, so it's easier to search.
That's exactly right.
I have to admit, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, how fun could that possibly be? But I signed up and I was playing the music recognition one, and it really was fun. And that's what I think is sort of interesting, is that you've engineered this in a way that, you know, it's not do your duty and help the internet. You've made it so that it's fun. What is it about humans and games that makes this work so well?
People really like to play games. In my research group, this is a sort of unfortunate, but we don't believe very much in altruism.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know that there are some people that are altruistic and that volunteer their time, etc. But we just don't believe we can get large amounts of effort being put in things that are just for volunteer causes.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to come up with ways to motivate people to actually do things. And one of them is playing games. In the United States, the average American spends 1.1 hours every day playing computer and video games.
Wow.
And that's fine by us, as long as a little bit of that effort is being spent on something that can be sort of reused.
Mm-hmm. So this is part of your larger sort of research project in a way, where you get people to help improve the internet by doing the kinds of things that we find easy but computers find difficult. What makes this such a compelling area of research for you?
I mean, what motivates me is this. With the internet, we can have literally hundreds of millions of people working on the same task. And if you think about it, before the internet era, so humanity's largest achievements, these like very large scale projects that we had done, so things like the pyramids of Egypt,
right,
or the Panama Canal or the Apollo space project where we put a man on the moon, all of these things, if you look at them, there's a funny, curious fact, and it's that all of them required about 100,000 people. And part of the reason for that is because before the internet, it was pretty much impossible to coordinate more than 100,000 people to work on the same thing.
Right.
Just getting them in the same place was almost impossible, right? But see, now with the internet, we can literally have 100 million people all working on the same thing. So a big question is, if we can put a man on the moon with 100,000 people, what can we do with 100 million?
Mm-hmm. Luis, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Luis von Ahn is one of the creators of CAPTCHAs and the ReCAPTCHA project. Twitter, Facebook, Ticketmaster, and Craigslist are just some of the sites using ReCAPTCHAs. So if you type in a blurry word at any one of those sites, you've helped digitize a book. Over at the Spark blog, I posted a link to GWAP, Games with a Purpose. He's a great one for acronyms, that Luis. And they're really fun. I think it would be a very cool thing for kids to do, too. So check it out. Just go to cbc.ca/spark and find the link from there.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over, and life is like a song.
Ever since I talked to Luis, I've been fascinated with the idea of what 100 million people could do if they were all collaborating. And that's the beauty of life online, those numbers. You just know that no matter who you are, what your unique interests are, there's someone out there who's a perfect match for you. And they're out there looking for you too. And when you find each other, you can finally get a great fitting pair of shoes. What? What did you think I was talking about? That's where John Lee comes in. He's the creator of UnevenFeet.com, a website based in Melbourne, Australia. So I called him up on Skype to find out the inspiration. So what size are your feet?
Well, depending on which time of the day you measure it, a full size to about a size and a half difference between my feet. That is pretty much the reason behind what you see on the website today.
And the thing is, I can feel John's pain. I have to say, my right foot is about an 8 and my left is about an 8.5. So
you've got a half size difference, yeah.
Yeah, I can kind of relate. So why do people with uneven feet need a special home on the web? Well, as a person with uneven feet, I never really get a good-fitting pair of shoes. So the idea for UnevenFeet.com is that you sign up, you list your foot sizes, and see if there's someone out there who's also signed up at Uneven Feet that you can swap shoes with. You know what they say, if the shoe fits, wear it.
It's all about trying to match up people based on something that we refer to as opposite matches. So in my case, my left foot is like an 11 and my right foot is, let's say, a 10. Mm-hmm. So my opposite match would be someone who has the larger right foot and the smaller left foot. So just the opposite of what mine is. So an 11 in the right and a 10 in the left, meaning that if we were to jointly purchase footwear, we'd both get the perfect fit just by swapping a couple of the shoes around.
Smart. Very smart. I guess you might have to put up with a little bit of, you know, the other person's tastes a little bit as well.
Like if yeah, exactly. Work. I mean, it's obviously there are limitations to, right. to how that works. But hopefully, given enough numbers, then if I had enough matches, hopefully I could find someone with similar tastes.
Now, this isn't a business for John. It's a side project that seems to be driven as much by curiosity about how common uneven feet are as it is by a desire for comfortable footwear. But still, it's a quirky example of a broader online trend. Swapping is a booming trend these days. You can swap homegrown vegetables on veggietrader.com. You can swap clothes at digandswap.com or rehash clothes. SwapTree lets you swap just about anything at all. Now, I'm sure this is partly because of tougher economic times, but it's also because what used to be a scarce commodity, information about who had what, is now easy to post and share. Maybe even to the point where there are enough people with uneven opposite feet that you can find that perfect match. Well, will you get back in touch once you figure out how many people are interested in using the site?
Sure. I mean, we can do an update and, however many weeks or months and let you know how it's going.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, John.
No problem. Thank you, Nora.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, this is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
I'm always nagging you to go to the blog, comment on what you heard, but we also like to get emails. Now, on a recent episode of Spark, I interviewed Roger Martin, author of a new book on using design thinking in business. Leland Young, no relation, sent me this email. You asked if any of your listeners are applying design thinking to their own careers, and it reminded me of my own project. I teach an English course, Storytelling in the New Millennium, at Dawson College in Montreal, that examines how new forms of digital media are changing the way that we deliver, receive, create, and experience stories or text. In trying to apply some of the concepts of the course, as well as trying to figure out how to deal with the ubiquitous cell phones and other electronic distractions, every member of the class opens a Twitter account, and they're encouraged to tweet comments and links during class. I project the class Twitter feed on the screen, and they contribute on their phones, laptops, or iPods. This is the third semester that I've used Twitter, and it's proven to be an effective way to get students to participate inside and outside of class. Chaotic at times, but students who might be too shy to put up their hands often find tweeting less intimidating. Don't know whether this counts as design thinking or merely an if you can't beat them, join them strategy, but it's working. Thanks again for a great show, Leland Young. You know, I've heard anecdotally from teachers using Twitter and other social media tools in the classroom, and I'd love to hear from more of you about your approaches. Email me at spark@cbc.ca.
How do you ask for a date? What about this?
Ann, this is Woody. Well, I have a ticket for the High Team Carnival Saturday, and, well, would you like to go?
Why, yes, Woody. That would be fun.
Oh, Woody, can't you show a little more self-confidence? Well, talking on the phone to a prospective date can be scary, and maybe that's why sending text messages to people we're just getting interested in romantically is an increasingly popular option. Now, it's just anecdotal, but we're observing this phenomenon more and more. Sounds lovely, sending sweet electronic nothings to romance a love interest, but we started wondering about the pitfalls. After all, romance is about FaceTime with your sweetie, right? We started wondering if texting might be killing the romance. So we sent Spark's romantic affairs correspondent Damon Fairless to scope out the situation. He's here in studio. Hi, Damon. I did not know we had a romantic affairs correspondent.
Hey, Nora.
So what did you find out?
Well, okay, first of all, I just want to say that, and without boasting, I kind of came up with a name for this, and I'm going to call it Romancing the Phone.
Clever.
It's a more tasteful than some other things I thought of, like textual intercourse.
Yes, okay. So how do you feel about this?
Well, basically, I feel it's super unromantic. I mean, I admit to my bias. I've just heard way too many bad stories about it.
Really? Because I actually think it's kind of sexy. It's like this private message between the two of you. But what stories have you come across?
Okay, well, take my friend Marie, for instance. She's awesome. She's beautiful. She's smart. She's funny. But she's had some really bad experiences with text dating. She, in fact, had a romance that was totally ruined by texting. Here, take a listen to her.
Things started out really nicely. Like, we actually talked on the phone a lot. We didn't text or email at all. And then we started texting each other, and it was fine. Then it kind of flipped to the other side. So we were not seeing each other that much, and I started to get frustrated because I felt like that was our only way we would communicate with each other, and I didn't feel that that style of communication really has any depth to it.
So the short and long of it is she broke up with the guy.
Right.
See what I mean? Texting ruined that relationship.
Okay, but it sounds kind of like they weren't actually seeing that much of each other, and then they started texting all the time. I don't know if you can really blame the texting for the breakup. You're making it sound, you know, evil.
Well, okay, not evil, but it's totally unromantic. I mean, she said after a while, the texting lost its cute factor. You know, it was cool at first. So from now on, Marie is going to be a little more cautious, I think, when it comes to dating and texting and seeing serial texters. But I wanted to get an expert opinion because, you know, really that's just one anecdote. So I want to see kind of when texting's okay, when it crosses the line. So I rang up Twana Hines. She's been on the show before.
Yeah, she's a blogger. She goes by Funky Browncheck.
That's right. Exactly. She's a writer and kind of a romantic or a relationship romance expert in New York City. Her point was that when it comes to romance, texting isn't good and it's not bad.
Texting is simply a form of communication, much like email, talking on the phone, meeting face to face. And so there's nothing inherently wrong with texting and dating. And actually, it can be very helpful. It's a way of e-flirting, so to speak. So I wouldn't necessarily use texting to initiate a first date or terminate a relationship or something like that. But I would certainly send an email to a guy after a successful first or second date and just say, hey, you know, had a great time.
Twana says when you're texting, you have to be careful that it doesn't replace the face-to-face.
Right.
And she made a really good point. If you think about it, when you first start dating, you're on your best behavior, trying to impress the other person, right? So what does it say if all you're getting, all you're doing is this back-and-forth texting, you're not really seeing the person? I mean, where's it going to go from there?
Yeah, I can see the point. I mean, it does seem a bit like taking the easy way out. Now, Damon, not to pick on you, but do you think that you find texting unromantic because you're a little older and not very good at texting? I mean, you know, it takes you like an hour to send a short text message.
Okay, Nora, first of all, that's because I have big fingers. It has nothing to do with my age. Okay, I'm not an amazing texter, I admit it. But I actually went out and I found some people who are. I went to Jean Vanier High School here in Toronto, and the students there communicate naturally through texting. They just do it all the time.
Right.
I wanted to know if they had some of the same feelings I do about texting, you know, someone who's a little older. So I asked him about romancing the phone, and I was actually pretty surprised. Here's Jamari Ambersley. He's a grade 12 student.
I think the whole texting thing in general is something that's not necessarily needed. To me, it seems like sort of impersonal. It's like you're doing everything from a a weird perspective. You wouldn't, like, you're not talking to a girl because you want to, like, see her in person. So it's not really, like, I want to see you, so I'm going to come to your house and tell you how I feel. I'm going to text it to you. So, because I can't say it to you in person, you know what I mean?
Right.
And then people lose that sense of, like, I don't know, companionship with friends, or whether it be, like, a lover or someone, like, that's why, to me, it's just, like, it's not really necessary.
Ha! Take that, Nora. A young person who finds texting unromantic. I have youth on my side. You can't argue with that.
Okay, but you're saying you didn't find any teenagers who texted their sweethearts?
No. Actually, Jamari was the exception. But I'll tell you this, texting causes problems for these young folks. Mm. One of my favorite moments when I was talking with students at Jean Vanier came from a guy named Jesse. He was telling me that texting can be like a veil that people hide behind so they don't actually have to express their feelings and be honest with the person they're dating. Here, take a listen.
When a girl says something and the guy doesn't feel the same way about it, the guy can hide under that veil, I guess, right?
So what do you mean, like, if you're not as
comfortable
like, expressing
it? Let's give an example. This, for the record, didn't happen to me. Let's say a girl says, oh, yeah, I love you so much, da 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 da. And the guy's like, oh, word.
Okay, all in all, I found the students I spoke with, they had a really good sense of where texting fit in their romantic lives. It wasn't a big deal. In fact, I found them actually less concerned about the whole thing than adults were. The only actual complaint I heard from kids was basically the same one I heard from adults, and that is that texting makes it easier to string someone along because you can just, you know, send out all these little messages without really committing to, well, you know, like going out on a date and hanging out with someone.
Right. It does enable the weasel factor for sure. So how do you make sure that you're not being strung along?
Well, that's a good question. So actually I put that question to Twana Hines, the dating expert in New York, and here's what she had to say about it.
How can you tell if you're being strung along via text message? One, trust your gut. I say this over and over again. It's that if you're getting the feeling that something may be occurring, trust that. And then the other thing is the old adage, actions speak louder than words. So if someone is sending you a text message to say, gee, really wish I could see you, well, actually make the effort to see the person. And so if you get the impression that you're being strung along via text message, I'd say those are probably the two key things to keep in mind.
You know, it's like email. I mean, texting just leaves out so much out of the picture. It's easy to, you know, to read things into it or misunderstand things. Good advice for any aspect of communication, texting or not. Damon, what are you doing?
Just a sec here. I'm just sending a message to my wife to tell her I love her, and then I'm going to meet up with her later for dinner, maybe buy her some flowers. I just don't want her to think I'm just, you know, romancing the phone.
That's very sweet, Damon, but at the rate you text, it'd be faster to call her. Thanks for checking it out.
No problem, Nora. See you later. Bye.
I am willing to bet that people have great stories about texting and dating. Do you know anyone who's been strung along by a text 'em and leave 'em type? Let me know, and I want to hear some dish. You can reach me at spark@cbc.ca or call our free in Canada hotline 1-877-34-SPARK. Now, when you were listening to that texting story, were you thinking, gosh, I'm old? Well, do I have some news for you? You're right. You are old. By one expert's measure, at least, mid-40s is officially old. Yikes, how do you like that? I spoke to the director of the MIT Age Lab, Joe Coughlin. We had a great chat about the future of aging.
The future of aging, if it's done well, you'll never really know that it was about aging. Robots will be in your house the day the robot is something that you want because it's cool and convenient at any age, not when you're older. I mean, one of the things we have to think about is that technologies and services and even policies that are designed for older folks generally have one problem with them. Younger people don't support them or buy them, and guess what? Older people don't buy them or support them. You can't build an old man's car, and I believe you really can't build an old man's robot either. And so the future of aging should be by stealth. The house that you live in when you're older is going to be the one that you bought in your 40s and 50s because it had all the support you needed for convenience, and now it happens to be in place when you need it at 80 and 90.
He certainly got me thinking about aging. We do a radical rethink of aging, and we look at how you can get the elder years that you deserve. We'll air that interview on an upcoming episode of Spark. But if you want to get ahead, we've posted the full interview to our website. If you have a spare 30 minutes this week, I'd love for you to take a listen and let me know what you think of Joe Coughlin's ideas. We'd love to get some of those comments on the air for that show. You can find Joe Coughlin's interview and more uncut conversations at cbc.ca/spark. Still ahead on today's show, transparency is the buzzword du jour in politics. I'll talk to one guy who thinks transparency is far from being the savior of democracy. In fact, it may be undermining it. And it's not some old school politician protecting a secret expense account either. It's tech savvy big thinker Lawrence Lessig. That's coming up on Spark. On Spark, when we talked about augmented reality, that's the idea that the real world around you is annotated with digital information. There's some pretty wide-eyed predictions about what might happen with AR down the road, but right now we're seeing it turn up in toys and marketing. For instance, we talked about a baseball trading card where you hold it up to the webcam on your internet-connected computer and a 3D animation pops up on your computer screen. Well, December's issue of Esquire magazine is an augmented reality edition. You hold the mag up to your webcam and cover boy Robert Downey Jr. pops up.
Ah! Booyah! In your face!
Cool as it is, I can't help but feel it's a sign of a troubled magazine industry jumping up and down saying, look, I'm relevant, I'm all internet-y.
Augmented reality even knows what time it is.
If you want to check it out, and I have to say it is pretty neat, we have a link at the website cbc.ca/spark. I'm Nora Young. This is CBC Radio 1, and you're listening to Spark, where we believe in getting your geek on.
There, miss. You see, the heterodynes are feeding back into the stimulus reaction activators, causing non-snaps of the motor control resistor units.
Oh, that's good.
No, lady, that's bad. But your regenerative circuits are tuned asynchronously, and that causes concatenation in the intermediate amplifiers.
Well, that's bad, isn't it?
No, that's good. From now on, I don't think there'll be the slightest trouble with your robot. Your domestic problems are completely solved.
Rolo, answer the door.
Oh, Rolo, is there anything you can't do? That was from back in 1940 before we'd figure out how to pronounce the word robot. It really seemed like robots like Rolo were in our very near future. Okay, what is that sound? Is it coming from the Spark test kitchen?
Recording? Am I bothering you?
Oh, hi, this is Hannah Glosson, our Same As It Never Was correspondent. Hannah, what on earth is that sound?
Oh, sorry, I'm just hanging out with my favorite little kitchen robot here. It's a little robotic chicken chef that sits on the countertop and plays and sings along to the Ring of Fire.
All right, a kitchen chicken robot. And what does it say on the apron there?
Oh, it says, my chicks got it cooking.
Lord, I don't even want to know where that comes from. Now, this is exactly what I'm talking about. We were promised these, you know, space-age robots for the household, and instead we have this singing, dancing chicken, which hardly lives up to expectations.
I know. Why, like, why don't I have a robot that actually does something useful? I mean, why am I still doing dishes? Why am I folding laundry? Where is my Rosie the robot from the Jetsons? Why don't I have a robo-maid?
So you do, to an extent. You have your little Roomba robots.
Who's that?
Well, that was my robot chicken. No, I'm joking. That's actually Raymond Morali. He's a PhD student in autonomous space robotics at the University of Toronto.
Autonomous space robotics?
Yes, and Raymond's been building robots for a long time. And he told me that we actually do have a lot of robots in the household, but they're not quite the science fiction version we imagine. So that's partly because robots are good at performing simple, repetitive tasks, and they're not so good at doing more complex things like making decisions.
Robots are very good at doing the same tasks repeatedly as opposed to dealing with unknowns. And when a Roomba is driving around an environment, it has no idea where it is. It just bumps off random walls and hopefully covers your entire floor. Whereas something that's, you know, fixed permanently, like your dishwasher, every time you press start, it goes through the same set of routines. So robots excel at that tedious, you know, repetitive tasks that humans generally don't excel at.
So we actually have lots of robots around us, like my chicken chef, which is good at the simple repetitive task of singing the Ring of Fire, or the scuba, which is a floor mopper, or even something like a washing machine or one of those coffee makers that grinds and brews coffee on a timer.
Right. Okay. So the point is that it's modeling what humans would recognize as intelligent behavior. That's kind of the challenge. They're sort of stupid.
Right, exactly. And that, in a way, is what makes them good at their jobs. For example, the Roomba, this robotic vacuum cleaner, it just goes back and forth and back and forth and around, and it doesn't get bored. And I mean, I don't know if you've seen a video of one of those things, but I'm bored just talking about it.
Okay, so the Roomba succeeds because it does one task over and over and over again, but it's a failure in what I would actually want a domestic robot to do, which is multiple tasks.
Right. Hey, Nora, do you want a beer?
Kind of early, but all right.
Stay with me on this, Nora. It's actually to prove a point. See, for me to get a beer, I have to walk to the fridge, open the door, look in the fridge, find the beer, close the door, walk across the room, hand you the beer, realize it's not a screw top, go to the cupboard, find a bottle
okay,
opener.
Okay, I get the point. For something that seems so simple, it's actually a pretty complicated task when you break it down.
Exactly. And I want to avoid all of that hard work. What I really want is a robo-butler. You know, like something in a tux and a tail that'll fix me some drinks and bring it over on a little tray. And when I was talking to Raymond Morali, the roboticist, he said he's actually seen such a thing.
But again, the problem is controlling the variables. So the one I saw, the fridge was on wheels, so the robot was a fridge. He knew exactly where the beer was. So he just did the same repetitive task, grabbed a beer from a very known location and threw it in a very known direction. So, but as soon as you start introducing more variables, like go find the beer, you know, look around in the fridge and try and find it, and then now you have vision problems of trying to identify, you know, a beer can from a pop can and so on and so forth. Or just opening the fridge door would require a different mechanism.
So, for example, to open the fridge door, my fingers can grasp the handle, my wrist can turn, my elbow can bend to pull the fridge door out. And building a robotic mechanism that can mimic human behavior in that way is actually really problematic.
You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about CAPTCHAs, which are based on the idea that humans are good at recognizing these squiggly letters and numbers, but that's a hard thing for computers to do. You know, and a human being can look at 10 different types of birds, from an ostrich to a sparrow, and recognize, oh, those are all birds. But that's actually an incredibly hard problem for AI.
Exactly. Or in the case of beer, for example, if I'm at my friend's house and I open the fridge and they have some fancy kind of beer that I've never seen before, I can look at it and know that it's still beer. Mm. My poor little robo-butler probably wouldn't know it hit him.
Right.
So there are lots of these considerations. I mean, Raymond Morali told me again about this other robot lawnmower that he built.
That doesn't sound like a very good idea, Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, it was called the Tron mower.
So the idea was similar. You can make the parallel to the Roomba, where it drives around in vacuums, whereas this one drives around with a 5-pound rotating blade and cuts the lawn. The issues arise when the environment changes. So if the lawn was always the same and it had to follow the same path, it could do that no problem. The problems we had is in the competition, they'd have this little stuffed animal on a remote control car. So it's like a dog just walked in front of the lawnmower. So you need to not kill that dog. So therein lies the problem.
So I should say that robot lawnmowers have since entered the market, like the $2,000 auto mower, and they claim to have addressed the safety concerns with this kind of technology. But still, Raymond's project kind of proves the point.
Right, which is the robots are good at following a specific set of instructions, but real life isn't really like that. There are all kinds of variables.
Right, but that doesn't mean that the dream of a home robot is over. There's still lots of research in this area right now, particularly around the idea of robots and accessibility, and robots and an aging population.
So I might get a robo maid after all?
Maybe, but it probably won't look like Rolo the robot.
Oh, what's the point?
Hey, so do you want another beer? I'm just going to kick back in the kitchen and listen to some Ring of Fire.
You're going to wear that chicken out. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
That is making fiery ring.
Yes, Rollo the robot, the chromium-plated butler, is just a daydream after all. But not so Rollo's little brother and sister robots, the millions of small mechanical servants that never ask for afternoons off, the amazing machines and gadgets that almost seem to think for themselves.
And it burns, burns, burns. The ring of life. The ring burns.
Okay, let's say you're a typical person going out to work. Maybe two or three times a week, you stop in the coffee shop on the corner. Order your drink, hand over your cash, you get a receipt, which you shove in your pocket and never think about again. Now, imagine for a second that you'd saved all those receipts from the last year, and you lay them all out end to end. Think of the story all those receipts could tell. You could figure out how much money you spent on coffee all year, or you could reorganize the receipts to figure out what times of day you drank decaf and when you ordered a double shot. Rearrange them again and see if you drank more in winter than in summer. Correlate it with a list of weather reports to figure out if you're more likely to sneak out of the office for a Java when it's sunny out. In short, organizing your data could tell you a lot about how you behave. Have you ever been really surprised by what a data visualization showed you?
I have, mostly about myself.
That's Fernanda Villegas.
I'm a researcher at IBM.
And Fernanda is a real innovator in the world of what's called data visualization. Folks doing data visualization reckon that if you can take all those data sets, like the date you bought your coffee, what you ordered, and how much you spent, and display it in easy-to-understand images, something as simple as a pie chart or novel as a tag cloud, you could learn an awful lot about, well, anything you wanted.
We also have kids who come to the website. So, for instance, this one kid uploaded this data set of all the pairs of socks in his family. And so there were, you know, mom socks, dad socks, sister socks, and whether they were black and white and blue. And it was this wonderful data set that was highly personal, highly meaningful to them. And what a neat use of information visualization.
That kid is just one of many people who posted data sets to Fernanda's project. She and her team at IBM designed Many Eyes. Many Eyes is a website that lets anyone anonymously upload data about their family's socks or government spending or international birth rates, and it automatically converts it into lovely visualizations. It might display it as a scatterpoint graph or a map of the world. And it allows you to interpret and interact with the data. You can comment on it, for instance, or sort the data by whatever filters you decide on. And that interaction is novel and important.
We noticed an interesting pattern, which was we would create these tools for people to explore data and come out with wonderful insights out of the data they were looking at, which is, you know, the mantra with visualization. But then we realized that people would really get into the analysis and the more powerful aspects of visualization when they were sharing these visualizations with others and when they were actually having conversations around the kinds of things they were seeing on the visualization. We sort of took a step back and thought, well, if one of the most empowering things that you can do with a visualization is to have a discussion about the data, why not design a visualization environment that actually lends itself to that?
And what power is there in getting people to interact with the data this way? What do you see the potential uses of this as?
The cool thing about visualization is that it allows you to very quickly get a sense of a lot of data. So imagine, for instance, that, you know, just to give you a recent example, the U.S. government just came out with the stimulus plan, which is a huge spending bill for all sorts of different projects that touches all sorts of different parts of the economy. So let's say you wanted to look at all the pieces of this plan all at once, and you wanted to know, oh, you know, this much money is going to the Department of Defense, this much money is going to science, this much money is going to education. How could you get all the numbers all at once in one screen? This is what visualization does. It gives you an overview of lots, you know, hundreds, lots of times thousands of data points all at once. And because of the way that our brains are built, we're very good at looking at patterns visually.
I guess the other thing, too, is that we just have access to such masses and mountains of data now that, in a way, I mean, it would be an impossible task to actually wade through all of it. And so if you have this ability to kind of more to have a more ambient understanding of what the data means just by looking at it, you get a sense of it. Maybe
absolutely.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And governments around the world have initiatives for transparency and accountability, where basically what they're doing is putting out more data. And their mission is, we're going to put the information out there. Now you make sense of it. And that's where visualization can really help. Mm. Citizens try to not only make sense of what things are going on around them, but to keep information contextualized, because one of the things that visualization does very well is to paint a very broad picture and then allow you to, you know, from that broad picture, zoom in into details and data points, but the data points are always contextualized.
Right. Are there political aspects to data visualization? I mean, I'm just thinking about, for instance, you know, the politics of the map of the world, how it ends up making Africa look smaller than it actually is. Are there comparable things in the world of data visualization that people have great debates about?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, in a sense, when you think about it, any sort of representation is a framing of reality. Data visualization is visualizing numbers. People love to say, well, you know, those are the facts. The truth is, that's a framing of reality too, because depending on how you got those numbers, there is a lot of limitations. There is a lot of, you know, we chose to measure this thing as opposed to that thing. That's on the data side. On the presentation side, you can do all sorts of things to, you know, make certain things look better or worse. So again, to get back to your question, these are different ways of telling the same story, right? It's the same data, and yet you end up with radically different images of the same story of the same data.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Fernanda.
Thank you. Same here.
We have a link to the Many Eyes project that Fernanda talked about up at the Spark website, cbc.ca/spark. Just look in the show notes for this week's episode. If you've tried out some data visualizations of your own, I would love to hear about it and what you think you learned from seeing data presented visually. Reach me at spark@cbc.ca or leave a comment at the show notes on the blog, and we can get a whole conversation going with the rest of the community. Listening to Spark, tech trends and fresh ideas. And I don't know if you've noticed, but there's one trend a lot of people have been talking about lately.
The path forward has to be with transparency.
But I want to talk about transparency.
The more transparency we have in the system, the more accountability we have in the system.
Transparency, so people can see, the ability to know where your dollar's going, how things are changing. Folks,
yeah, transparency, particularly transparency in government. It's definitely hotting up. Last season, we talked to Councillor Andrea Reimer about Vancouver opening up its municipal data, things like bus routes and garbage schedules, so that citizens can access it and find ways to make it useful to residents. Just this month, Toronto launched toronto.ca/open with an aim to build, quote, a city that thinks like the web. And I want to talk more about transparency in government today. Now, a lot of what we've been hearing over the past year is very pro-transparency. And for the most part, people seem to agree that opening up the way government works and government data is a very good thing. But recently, the magazine The New Republic published an essay called Against Transparency: The Perils of Openness in Government. And there's been lots of talk online about this essay because it takes the controversial position that there are significant drawbacks to government transparency. The other reason for the buzz is because of who wrote the essay.
My name's Lawrence Lessig. I'm a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and I'm the director of the Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics at Harvard University.
Lawrence Lessig is a big fish in the internet ethics pond. In addition to teaching at Harvard, he was the founder of Stanford Law School's Center for Internet and Society. He's one of the guys who's front and center in the fight to reform copyright law in the U.S. In short, Lessig is a leader, and he's just not the first guy you would expect to rock the pro-transparency boat.
Now, to be clear, Lawrence's article isn't about getting rid of transparency in government. It's about recognizing that, along with all the democratic good that it can bring, there are also costs.
The places that I've worried about transparency is in contexts where the data that's being released will clearly have a certain meaning to people that's not necessarily related to actually what it means. And in particular, in the context of the United States, I'm fearful about the way in which data about influence that members of Congress are alleged to have because of contributions to their campaigns will have in the political system. I think that what it tends to do is drive an enormous amount of cynicism. And so if that's all that one does is produce data that leads people to be cynical, it's not clear that one's doing good for democracy.
Could you give me an example of how that plays out with influence in the American case?
Well, here's one example I wrote about in the piece in The New Republic. Hillary Clinton, when she was First Lady Clinton, is credited with stopping what really was a truly awful bill from becoming law, a bill which eventually did become law in the form of the Bankruptcy Act of 2006. When she became Senator Clinton, 2 years mm-hmm. later, the bill came back before the United States Senate. And in the interim, she had received about $140,000 in contributions from the credit card companies and financial services industries. And in the year 2001, she voted twice in favor of that bill. Now, you know, when that flip is remarked and you tell people of the money, they immediately draw the conclusion that it's because of the money that she made the flip, when in fact there are any number of reasons that she might have changed her position, including the fact that she's the New York senator now and before she was First Lady. But all of those other reasons have pale in comparison to what is the salient reason in most people's mind about why anybody in politics would change when so much money is on the table, and that's because of the money. Mm-hmm. We're in a context where one can't help but draw this inference when one points to money, even when there's not really enough evidence to suggest or support the claim that it's actually because of the money that they made, the decision they made.
Right. And so the problem would be comparing it to simply making the data available versus, say, something like the Telegraph newspaper did in the UK, where they looked into expenses scandals and did the due diligence around researching exactly what the information meant. Is that the distinction there?
Yeah, so that's one point. So you can do a better job with the data. But still, I think that even if you do the best possible job with the data is still going to be ambiguous in many contexts. And so, you know, what's the upshot from that? Many people think that when you say, geez, transparency is going to produce this bad result, you're therefore arguing we shouldn't have transparency. But that's certainly not what I believe. My point is, once we recognize the bad result that transparency has, in a context where members of Congress are being elected by raising an extraordinary amount of money, typically from very narrow sets of interests, mm-hmm. the response should be to change the way in which members of Congress get elected.
And I mean, you talk about this as a sort of pathology of the technology, right? That you have this technology that combines the networked ability of computers with incredibly cheap information storage so that now we just have all this data available that we never have had available before.
Right. I mean, I think that I wanted to be very ambiguous about whether you think of it as a pathology. And, you know, I linked it at the end of this piece that I wrote to other prominent examples of how digital technologies have changed things. So think about the music industry, you know, which has gone apoplectic about the consequence of the digital technologies for their way of doing business. Or think about journalism and the fear of many that major institutions of journalism are going to be destroyed, and partly, people believe, because of digital technologies. In those two contexts, you know, we have basically three kinds of responses. Break the internet. Let's, you know, find a way to stop this technology because it's going to destroy our business. Or you have the opposite response, people saying, so what? The industry, so what if the music industry gets destroyed? Who cares? They're not so important anyway. Let's just, you know, let them die and let's get on with sharing things freely. And then there's a third response, I think a much more sophisticated, mature response, which is to say, we're not going to get rid of the internet. We're not going to get rid of a world where perfect duplication is possible and easy distribution is possible. So what we need to do is have policies that take that into account and minimize the harm, because there's enormous benefit from it. I'm arguing for the third response. I'm saying we got to accept there's transparency. We got to accept every single thing a congressperson does is going to be out there mined by the, you know, geniuses from Google or Google wannabes. But what can we do to minimize the downside from that? What can we do to make it so that when that's done, the consequence isn't that people think democracy is broken. Instead, they can begin to think about how we can use democracy for the purposes it was meant for.
You don't want to break the internet.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to break the internet.
And yet, you know, this article against transparency has been a kind of controversial. You know, it's triggered a lot of debate and discussion. Do you think we're just at – it just seems that we're at this point where things tend to be, you know, if you're not for us, you're a Guinness, kind of polarizing. Were you surprised by how sort of controversial this article was?
Well, you know, I wasn't surprised – in a sense, by the controversy it engenders among readers, you know, because in some sense, the article can't help but demonstrate its point. You know, so if you went to the New Republic's website and you started reading this article, you'd have to click through 9 pages
right.
of, you know, text before you got to the end. You don't understand the point of the argument until you get to the end. So one of the points in the article is the negative consequence of limited attention span. Well, here, look, you know, many people reacted to the article in a way that had no relationship to what the article actually says because of a limited attention span. Mm. Now, again, as I say, it's not a normative claim that, you know, you're bad because you've got a limited attention span. We're all busy. We don't have time to spend, you know, an hour on every single thing that gets written about a subject we care about. So part of my point is how do we deal with a world where we need to convey information for an attention span the size of a tweet when, you know, some issues actually take more than a tweet to understand?
Do you think that part of it is not just the volume of information, but also the character of digital information is that it can often be decontextualized, that it's easy for people to look at parts of, you know, an article in the New Republic without actually reading it in a linear form from A to Z, and things, you know, statistics, information can all be snatched out from its context?
You know, I'm relatively optimistic about the capacity to learn from this. I had the experience when I was a kid, just during college, I spent a lot of time traveling in former Soviet republics. I mean, then they were still the Soviet republics, but I was in St. Petersburg and I was on a train with a professor who told me that, you know, this is 1982. He said to me, mm-hmm. you know, actually we have a better system of free speech in Russia than you do in the United States. And mm-hmm. I said, you know, what could you possibly mean by that? And he said, well, you know, in the United States, you wake up and you read the New York Times or you read the Wall Street Journal and you think you know the truth. In Russia, we wake up and we read newspapers, and we know that every newspaper is lying to us. So we have to read 7 different newspapers, and we have to triangulate to try to figure out what, in fact, the truth is. And so we're actually better at understanding the world because we're so skeptical of everything that's being said to us. And my sense is that, you know, the digital generation that's, you know, between the age of 16 and 19 is increasingly like that Russian. You know, nothing really surprises them. Nothing really disturbs them. They kind of take everything in and become better than certainly, you know, people in their 60s are at triangulating in this sense. And so, you know, I think the culture has a way to respond. But one of the ways to respond is to try to be clear about what problems are going to be solvable by secrecy, which I think increasingly none, and which problems have to be solved by institutional changes. And that's obviously what I was trying to talk about.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Lawrence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up at the Spark blog at cbc.ca/spark, you can find my full unedited interview with Lawrence if you'd like to delve more deeply into this topic. For instance, we talked about whether the kind of data visualization tools that Fernanda mentioned earlier in the show can help us understand these great masses of data better. That's it for Spark this time around. Spark is made by Elizabeth Bowie, Dan Meisner, and me, Nora Young, and by
Luis Fonan,
Jonathan Lee,
Damon Fairless,
Hannah Clausen,
Fernanda Viegas,
Lawrence Lessig,
Daniel Jones,
and Robert Downey Jr.
Booyah! In your face!
Spark is made with Creative Commons music and effects. Find the artists and titles at the blog. That's also where you can comment on what you've heard or listen to this whole show again if you like. But hey, if you like the sound of that, why not sign up for the Spark podcast? Just go to cbc.ca/spark and click on podcasts. It's easy, it's free, and you don't need an iPod. For Spark, I'm Nora Young. Talk to you next time.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.